number 428, Rick A. Holton versus Krauss Cartage Company, Mr. Barnes.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. My name is Jack Lines, counsel for the petitioners, Rick and Sherry Holton and their children, who I'm happy to have in the courtroom. Please stand up. Thank you very much. Folks that have not come down here to observe and to a limited extent participate in these proceedings. Also with me at counsel table is Kathleen St. John, here as counsel for MECAS, Ohio Academy of Trial Lawyers. What Kathy and I would like to do is speak for 6 to 6.5 minutes apiece and reserve 2 or 3 minutes for rebuttal. Kathy is going to focus her comments upon the validity of 4123-931, the subrogation statute, as it is written. I, on the other hand, am going to submit to this court that Article 2, Section 35 of the Ohio Constitution does not authorize the Ohio General Assembly to enact any legislation that compels injured employees to give back benefits paid to them under Chapter 4123 of the Code. Indeed, we believe that Section 35 prohibits such legislation for so long as employers continue to enjoy immunity from liability. Turning to the first question then, does Article 35 authorize passage of a workers' comp subrogation statute? We believe the answer to that question is clearly no. Article 2, Section 35, states that laws may be passed for the purpose of providing compensation to injured employees. It does not provide that laws may be passed for the purpose of depriving injured employees of compensation already earned and paid to them. Section 35 goes on to call for compulsory contributions by employers to the state fund. We submit that a workers' compensation subrogation statute is a form of compulsory contribution by the injured employees, which is simply not authorized by any reasonable construction of Section 35 of Article 2. The respondent, on the other hand, claims that subrogation is permitted as a term and condition of eligibility. We believe that a clear and precise and reasonable reading and interpretation of Section 35 demonstrates that the respondent's argument is simply incorrect. Section 35 limits the legislature's authority to laws relating to terms and conditions upon which payments shall be made from the state fund, not payments coming back into the state fund, which is what we have in the present situation.
Wouldn't that also be true of recoupment, though? Recoupment, whenever an employer has wrongfully had to pay, and after it used to reach the district board, or let's say we reversed and said the employer didn't have to pay, they can usually recoup from the surplus fund.
From surplus fund, yes, Your Honor.
But there also was a provision that said that they had to, that the injured party had to repay the amount that he was overpaid.
Your Honor, I'm simply not aware of any cases where an injured employee has been required to pay back benefits received under the system or has been sued in any sort of recoupment situation.
Well, we said that they couldn't do that, but they, earlier on, that used to be the case.
Absolutely, but it's not the law.
So you're saying that would have been another reason not to uphold that because it doesn't contemplate payment back to the fund.
It certainly would not be a term and condition as Section 35 of the Constitution, Article 2 of the Constitution is written. That's correct.
Counsel,
cases that we've seen recently, but it seems to be
had applied circumstances worked what would seem to be the grave of justice.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if you're making the word yet. I'm not totally hearing you.
All right. My question is, if the statute has problems merely because it can't have reverse application in certain fact situations, we're really not asked to answer those questions, are we? What's certified to us? That is, as applied, it could be unconstitutional, but on its face.
I think the court would have the opportunity to answer the certified questions under either or both situations, either as applied or simply as a matter of law. Your attorney take the position that the statute is unconstitutional, inherently unconstitutional, because it contradicts Section 35 of Article 2, but also as applied, or as would be applied in this case or any other case, is unconstitutional.
Well, that's the problem. We don't have an application here. That's Justice Piper's point. There is no, you couldn't possibly, in this procedural setting, get an as-applied ruling for your client. Only, it's only
on
a facial challenge.
Absolutely. Based on the record, we don't have that.
Right.
It is our position that Section 35 not only does not authorize a workers' comp subrogation statute, but that it in fact prohibits the passage of such a statute. We believe that it does so, so long as employers continue to enjoy immunity from suit. Section 35 provides that such compensation shall be in lieu of all other damages, and any employer who pays such compensation shall not be liable to respond to damages. Section 35, we submit, clearly mandates a quid pro quo between the employers and the employees of the state of Ohio. The employers' costs are capped, and they are otherwise immune from liability for common law negligence. The employees receive assurances of continuation of wages and benefits where injuries occur on the job without regard to the issues of fault. We submit any statute that unilaterally negates or impacts that dynamic is clearly a violation of Section 35 and runs afoul of the Ohio Constitution. If the shoe were on the other foot, if the legislature had passed a statute indicating, authorizing employees to file common law suits against their employers, even though the employers were continuing to pay premiums or compensation under Chapter 4123 of the Code, we submit that the roles would be reversed here today. The Bureau and the self-insured employers would be here arguing, citing this court to Section 35 of Article 2, saying that we've got a deal here. We gave them assurances of continuation of benefits in exchange for which we receive immunity. Now you have this statute that says they can sue us in addition to receiving benefits, and that's clearly upsetting the apple cart. The subrogation statute accomplishes the same destruction of that dynamic.
From a policy standpoint, what is wrong with the state saying that if an employee on a job is injured by a third party, that we'd like, in our interest, the state's interest in keeping the fund viable, we think we ought to be able, the state ought to be able to collect some of the recovery, some of the money that the plaintiff in the civil suit receives from the third party tortfeasor, and reimbursement is only for subrogation, reimbursement is only for the kinds of costs that medical and the kinds of costs that workers' compensation is paid. You're allowed to keep, employee, you can keep the pain and suffering, and the other amounts of the civil judgment that we, the state, haven't given you in workers' compensation. What, from a policy standpoint, and that's constitutional law oftentimes depends upon policy, the law of fairness, what's wrong with that? This is a general premise.
As a general premise, there's nothing wrong with it, Your Honor. We believe, however, that this so-called double recovery argument is simply a red herring to distract from the real issue of whether or not the subrogation statute violate Section 35 with respect to the quid pro quo that that section establishes. We believe that the issue of double recovery has nothing to do with the validity of a subrogation statute. What Section 35 does is establish a balance between the employers and the employees. The employers are protected, the employees get the benefits. As a matter of policy, a subrogation statute allows the employers to maintain that immunity, but they give up nothing for it in return. They have recouped all their losses, recovered all the benefits paid, but they are still immune from liability. The employer has no opportunity to sue the employer for any negligence which the employer committed that contributed to causing the employee's injuries in the first place.
Okay, so you're saying that even in a third party, where there's a third party tortfeasor, the employer maybe, which is an agreement,
Absolutely. The third party is a distraction, Your Honor. We believe you have to look at the underlying basis of the system as a whole. You have the contract between the two groups. The employers get the immunity, the employees get the benefits. You now allow the employers to take back those benefits.
The statement is made by the respondents that every state permits some form of subrogation in its workers' compensation system. I don't know, you've laid out state by state. What about the constitutions in those states? Is Ohio's constitution rare? I mean, is it very unique that we have a different provision in our constitution that we should be different than every other state?
Mr. Chief Justice, I can only apologize to the court. I honestly wanted to make an effort to examine some of those other states' constitutions to see how they compare, because I believe that was and certainly is a relevant issue. After reviewing all the other states' 50 statutes, I just couldn't find the time or the energy to go back and try to...
We've got all kinds of time. We'll do that.
Mr. Fines, I'm struggling with the exact language of the statute, Article 2, Section 35, which says, of course, the General Assembly can pass laws establishing a state fund, so on, and determining the terms and conditions upon which payments shall be made therefrom. Why can't the General Assembly, as one of the terms and conditions for payment, say that if you collect from another party, you return what we've given you?
Governor, first of all,
I understand your argument that this is a welfare statute and a quid pro quo and all that. But those specific words, determining the terms and conditions.
That's my argument. Those specific words, the word from, or therefrom actually, to me is the key to the subrogation statute as a general concept. This does not say, the problem with the subrogation statute is that it deals with the issue of returning funds after they've already been paid from the state fund. This constitutional provision does not talk in those terms. It talks about payments being made therefrom, not returning thereto. That's why I think the phrase therefrom, or the word therefrom, is contrary to the notion of a subrogation statute.
Isn't therefrom modified by terms and conditions?
Absolutely. But again, okay, we're talking about terms and conditions under which the payments will come from the fund, not be made repaid to the fund.
And one of the terms and conditions for payment from the fund is that it's returned if it's collected from somebody else.
I don't think that language in the statute would be consistent with this language in the Constitution. In any event, I think if the legislature were to do that, I think the only proper remedy for the legislature or this court to then also address is to determine that the employer who recovers those funds is no longer immune from liability. If we don't have a compensable injury, because we define a compensable injury as one for which you did not recover any benefits from a third party, then the immunity which the employer otherwise gets for making those payments should not apply.
Mr. Fines, I think your position would be, it sounds like it is based somehow that the Constitution takes into consideration more than the amount recovered, you know, that a right to compensation. Rather, it seems that you're arguing the Constitution actually concerns itself with which way checks go, whether checks come one way. You think the Constitution concerns itself with that detail? Or is it concerned with payment of a certain amount, or, you know, whatever eligible amount the General Assembly decides a claimant is entitled to for whatever dire injuries, you know, befall someone on the job, but the checks going back and forth so that the claimant nevertheless retains an amount as set forth in, you know, popularly enacted legislation, you think the Constitution deals with which way the transaction ultimately is conducted?
I believe that the Constitution, Section 35, was deliberately written to be one-sided with respect to those checks, because the drafters acknowledged that the major thing that the employees were giving up was their right to pursue their claims against the employers for negligence. And therefore, everything else that precedes that is the checks to go the other way. And I can only cite the court to the fact that if Section 35 specifically requires contributions, mandatory contributions, only by the employers to the state fund.
To the fund.
It does not talk about contributions by the employees.
But I guess the problem is considering this subrogation, the employee contributing to the fund, if the net amount to the employee meets the statutory requirements for the compensation that the employee, to which the employee is entitled, would we be saying that the employee effectively is contributing to the fund? Is in effect, is that what's going on?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the employee still has not been granted his right to sue the employer for any negligence of the employer, even though he's paid back all those benefits. And that's the inherent problem of any subrogation statute.
Thank you, Mr. Fines. Mr. Barnes.
I'm sorry, I didn't leave 6 minutes for my co-counsel.
You know, red light means 15 minutes have been expended, but I'll give Ms. St. John a little time. Mr. Barnes.
May it please court, counsel. This case, the subrogation statute, is not about depriving the injured worker of any compensation.
Counsel, let me take you to what troubled me about the statute, and maybe I just don't understand how it works. It's not a facial issue. It is how the statute ultimately works. If a person injured, such as the person in this case, may have a claim against other parties, and they settle that case for trial, and there is a general award of compensation, what happens then under the statute as far as this is a self-insured employer in this case?
No.
This is a fine employer?
Yes.
Yes. Is it different whether it's a self-insured employer?
No.
Same statute applies?
Yes.
So what happens?
What happens is if there is a general verdict, the subrogee is entitled to full subrogation pension. However, the statute provides a safeguard to prevent that from happening by way of special verdicts in a federal court case, the jury interrogatories, and state court, which would specifically designate the types of damages. An example of how...
So who's obligated to get the jury award broken down or a settlement? Is that on the injured employee?
The injured employee, unless the injured employee also joins the subrogee as a party, as is authorized pursuant to the statute. In fact, any of the three parties may submit interrogatories.
So the state or the self-insured employer is going to be right in this case.
If the injured worker joins the subrogee as a party, which is what the statute encourages.
Now, say that's broken down, and there's an award for what are the recoverable items?
The recoverable items for the subrogee are limited to workers' compensation and medical expenses. Now,
Future as well as present?
As well as future.
Now, there's where I begin to have a problem.
They get paid.
Okay, I assume this goes to trial, and the injuries are horrible, so the projections are that the future medical benefits are going to be tremendous. Does that then all go back to the state or to the self-insured employer?
Unless
if there's a huge award, say there's several $100,000 because of future.
If only if you assume that the subrogee controls the estimated future value, each of the parties has an opportunity to present a dollar amount of their respective calculation to the jury. And in any case, whether it involves workers' compensation for action or for action only, is going to require the calculation of estimated future value. Right? So there really is no difference.
I think you don't interest me. This total amount, whatever it's determined to be, then goes to the state or to the self-insured employer.
Assuming those are the expenses which the subrogee has borne or will reasonably bear.
Now, what happens if this injured employee dies 2 years later?
That's a risk of any calculation.
So the state pockets the money or the self-insured employer pockets the money?
That
they never pay that?
Well, that's a risk of estimate, which any
seems to me that is a constitutional risk of writing a statute.
But there's
that way.
Okay, but there's also the chance that the state will, or the subrogee will underestimate and will receive less.
Okay, which, you see the problem that concerns me with the statute. Now my question is, do we have an opportunity to address that issue in this case?
I think so. And it's
unconstitutional.
Well, let me backtrack. No, because the applied standard is not here.
That's what I thought.
However, in that case, in regard to future estimated values, I don't think there's a constitutional issue because of the reasonable standard. And it works both ways. It works to the benefit of the tortfeasor, the injured worker, as well as the subrogee. This is a straightforward subrogation case where, as Justice Moyer mentioned, all 50 states have workers' compensation subrogation statutes, and Ohio is not unique. We did review those other states, and Ohio is not unique. The differences in the statutes go to upfront attorney's fees. And some states do.
But the question the chief posed was not the differences among the statutes, but if somehow ours is constitutionally infirm because there's some distinctive aspect to the Ohio Constitution that isn't found in the other states.
And there is no distinction. There is no distinction.
So you don't think under 4123.93, one flat extension such as A and D, which deals with the future compensation, you don't think then that we can really address that?
No. But even if you did, the reasonableness standard, I believe, remedies that they perceive.
If you had a jury where it broken down into a jury that $100,000 is medical expenses, $300,000 is for pain and suffering for the medical expenses for 30 years. The person dies in a car accident for 2 years. The state keeps $300,000. They don't have to pay back the fortune for their chances for their lifestyles come off today. That's no different than you're talking about the risk factor. The state keeps $100,000, but the state also keeps the $300,000 that was a 30-year projection and that was in June.
Yes, and the $300,000 which the subrogee would have to go entitlement to because it's something other than medical expenses. And there's been a proposition that workers' comp, obviously, tort victim injured on the job somehow receives less than the tort victim injured off the job. And there are no circumstances whereby that could happen. When a case goes to trial, the tort victim, let's assume that there's an award of $100,000 and it's broken down by $10,000 in medical expenses, which happens to be the very same amount that the subrogee has paid out in medical expenses. The subrogee is entitled to that $10,000 minus attorney's fees and other expenses associated with gaining that award. So the subrogee will never receive its full recovery simply because of the deduction that's in place pursuant to the statute for gaining that award. The petitioners have also cited two comparative negligence actions in support of their position. Those cases bear out that the workers' compensation tort victim is always at an advantage. Again, going back to the jury award with the $10,000 award for medical expenses, if the injured worker is 40% negligent, that $10,000 award is reduced by $4,000, and the injured worker receives $6,000. However, if the tort victim injured on the job, again, $10,000 paid by the subrogee minus the 40% comparative fault of the injured worker still equals $10,000. Nothing has been taken from the injured worker because full workers' compensation, full medical expenses have been afforded to the injured worker, regardless of fault, whereas there's a reduction for the tort victim injured off the job.
Major argument in what the issue is on the constitutionality in Article 2, Section 35. I'd like you to look at subsection B of the statute with me for just a moment, because it struck me when I read it that I've been involved in these kind of cases way back in practice. B says a claimant shall notify a statutory subrogee of the identity of all third parties, and then no settlement or compromise shall be final unless the subrogee is notified. Then the next sentence, if a statutory subrogee is not given that notice by the claimant, right?
Yes.
The third party and the claimant shall be jointly and severally liable to pay the statutory subrogee the full amount of subrogation interest, which then renders the third party liable twice on the basis of something the claimant didn't do.
I'm not sure that it does.
Why? The third party and the claimant shall be jointly and severally liable to pay the subrogee the full amount of the subrogation interest. I mean, we're concerned about double recovery by the claimant in these cases.
Well, that's not the primary concern. That's one of the concerns.
Okay. Let's get over there. That's one of the concerns, the double recovery. But in any event, that's not important for that sentence. Doesn't that sentence say the third party, if the claimant doesn't notify the statutory subrogee, that the third party is going to be responsible?
Yes.
It does,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that there would be...
However, that does not prevent the third party tortfeasor from also notifying the Bureau. The purpose behind that language is to provide an incentive for the parties to bring a real party in interest to the table to resolve all issues at one time.
Yeah, I understand the policy. I understand the policy and understand your explanation, except that's not what it says. It says a claimant shall notify. And you're saying that the tortfeasor could notify too. My other question is, you say that the statute encourages the joining of the subrogee as a party plaintiff, in effect.
If the injured worker questions the validity of the subrogation, specifically provides in subsection. If you question whether the subrogee has a real subrogation interest.
Okay, well, what?
Or the amount, then you.
Let's say that the claimant accepts the subrogation statute, 4123.931. It's found to be constitutional. In every case, can the claimant join the subrogee as a party plaintiff?
Yes.
Okay, so all of this. It would be like we could handle the collateral benefits. I was wondering as I read it whether or not this is a collateral benefit and whether it impacts the collateral benefits rule that we had. The jury would have before it that the claimant, the plaintiff in that case, is claiming X number of dollars, so much of which is going to have to go back to the subrogee. Now, the subrogee comes in and sits as a plaintiff?
No, it protects its own interest. The subrogee does not sit in the plaintiff's stead. You then have three parties protecting their separate interests.
But it is proper for the plaintiff to present the fact that the subrogation is an issue and that a certain amount of the verdict, if any, is going to be paid back to the employer.
Yes.
That would be proper for a plaintiff to do. Thank you, Mr. Barnes.
My time is expired.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Did say John, 30 seconds. You know my rule.
Yeah. And before you take your 30 seconds, why isn't that fair? Why not just join the subrogee?
The statute permits you to join the subrogee. I think the Ohio Academy's main problem with the statute is what it does in the settlement context, which is where most of our cases are getting resolved. And this is a spatial deficiency with the statute. This is not an ad to fly. I mean, a lot of our hypotheticals involve facts that may not be in this case. This case came to this court on a broad certified question. Is the statute constitutional under this provision? Is it constitutional under this provision? If Your Honor answer that question, no, that forces us out of our ability to litigate this later. But more importantly, our settlement problems happen every single day in our practices. And yes, we can join the subrogated party, but in the settlement context, it doesn't make any difference. They're not going to do anything. They may or may not be willing to compromise the amount that they're entitled to, but they do not have to. And so the problem we run into on a daily basis is that an automatic, they get superior rights. This is an equal protection.
Now, wait a minute. How is it superior rights? You know, going into a settlement conference, that there is, in effect, a lien against any settlement.
Yes.
You know that. So you take that into consideration with settlement, don't you? How is the difference, what's bothering me, how is it any different than what we went through in all those cases when, and what was the term used in the Blue Cross Blue Shield? Coordination of benefits. Coordination of benefits with Blue Cross and Blue Shield clearly says that after this whole thing is over, you pay back the medical expenses Blue Cross and Blue Shield advanced on your behalf. How's that different?
I'm not sure if that's a legislative provision or not, and I'm not challenging at this moment that particular legislative provision. What I'm saying is the legislature can't coordinate our benefits and deprive us of part of the money that we're entitled to, because frequently in the settlement context, we're talking about limited funds that will not make us whole. And the only way we will have the ability to be made whole, or at least come as close as we can feasibly do, is by being able to enter into our own settlement negotiations and obligating the subrogee to enter into its own settlement negotiations. But it shouldn't be able to come in and take dollar for dollar everything it's paid out from our settlement. The In Re Estate of Ross case is a perfect example of this. The widow and minor children received nothing out of the partner coverage.
Why don't you bring yourself to take this? Why don't you say, come sit with us and look at the facts and look at the evidence that compromises us?
But frequently they do. The point is, before we're made...
They cite that they've been doing this over and over and over, and it only takes to get them, so some of them must be working.
But the reality is, if they've been given something by the legislature that is a special privilege that we shouldn't have to be able to. We shouldn't be put. The legislature has not even the playing field. It's given them a special privilege that we don't have. If they're
100% within their assessment, if you can't get what you want, you go to the jury and let them know.
If every single case where we were going to be deprived some of our settlement, I mean, obviously people compromise because they're stuck with it, so the legislature can't impair individual rights and take some of the money away from them, which is what the statute, particularly in the settlement context, does without having a rational basis for doing that. And it doesn't have a rational basis for making us give automatically, irrevocably.
When did all of this involve voluntary settlement? How does that create a constitutional right to voluntary settlement?
I think it's a part of the bundle of rights implicit in the right to a remedy. We at least have a right to...
We don't give you a right to a remedy by saying you have a right to settlement. We give you a right to a remedy by saying you have a right to support it, even though it's...
I think the point is, well, first of all, with respect to the right to a remedy, the end goal of any tort action is to recover damages. Now, if every single case went to trial, the court system would be overwhelmed. The settlements happen in 90-some% of the cases because that is how the legal system operates. And so to impair one's ability is to create an interference. Even if it's only judged under a rational basis standard, the legislature has to have a rational basis for why it is impairing that right.
You were about to tell us, you mentioned a case, which was an example of how you didn't work in the enormous
In-ray state of Rock.
Just tell us that.
1997, Court of Appeals in Oklahoma County held the statute constitutional. The fact of the case were that a father of a family was killed. He once received workers, or the family, the surviving spouse, and minor children received workers' compensation benefits as a result. They bring a suit against the tortfeasor. The tortfeasor has $100,000 policy limit. Once you have $100,000 policy limits, you settle for that. There's no point in going to trial at that point. You're not going to get anything more. They settle for that. and then the workers' comp subrogee comes in, and the court makes a decision based on the plain language of the statute that the attorney fees come out first along with the cost, and after that, the subrogation lien ate up the entire rest of the $100,000. That family, that wife, and survive those minor surviving children get absolutely nothing except workers' compensation benefits. Their tort remedy has been taken by the plain operation of the statute, and what are we going to trial against them? Let's assume that they get a jury verdict. When the jury comes in and says, okay, workers' comp has a $400,000 subrogation lien, and we see, survivor losses of $600,000.
So I think you've made the point, and that is the as-applied, that I had in the back of my mind that maybe I wasn't articulating well, the problem with the statute, to me. But how do we get to that in the answer to these certified questions?
I believe so, and I believe that in the settlement context, it's much more difficult than challenging a jury verdict. And moreover, I think what you're describing is as applied, I see as, and we're looking at the face of the statute. What does the face of the statute require? I'm not sure that that's completely as applied. Thank you.
You've used your 30 seconds. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The case was submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.